Tonight, I announce that the budget is back in the black and Australia is back on track.
Yeah! This is Please Explain. I'm Tory Maguire. It's Wednesday morning and I'm in Parliament House in Canberra. Last night, Treasurer Josh Frydenberg handed down his first, and possibly last, federal budget.
My 15 years in Parliament, I've seen a lot of budgets. I've never seen a Treasurer deliver a budget on a Tuesday night and have to explain why he got it wrong on Wednesday morning like this Treasurer has.
Scott Morrison is expected to kick off the election campaign as early as this weekend.
No way you said the budget's back in the black and it's not.
Because the budget is back in the black. That's what a budget is. It's for the next financial year and it's taken us 12 years to get here. And what's more important about the surplus is how we're going to invest it.
Bill Shorten is already in campaign mode.
Last night's budget is a political con designed to help the government get through the next 6 weeks and make Australians forget the last 6 years of cuts to schools and hospitals.
Morrison's visit to the Governor-General is now a mere technicality, so let's get straight into last night's budget. I'm joined now by Chief Political Correspondent David Crowe, Senior Economics Correspondent Shane Wright, and Senior Economics Writer Jessica Irvine. Now I've said all their titles, we're just about out of time. Welcome, guys. You're all still looking quite alive, if a little tired, after last night's budget. Thank you for getting up early to come and join us on Please Explain. David, I want to start with you. Can you please tell us what was in last night's budget?
Yeah, there were sort of four key elements. The first one being that they're projecting a surplus of $7.1 billion for next year. Now, contrary to some, I guess, hopes that they might have done better than that, they've still got a deficit of $4 billion or so in this financial year. So it's still a forecast of a surplus rather than a delivery of one you can count on right now, subject to economic conditions. So that's point one. The second element was this major tax cut of $158 billion over 10 years. Now, the really, you know, astonishing thing in some ways about the scale of this cut is that it's on top of the $144 billion tax cut over 10 years in last year's budget. Last year's package has been legislated. Now they've gone beyond that with a three-stage plan that is going to be very difficult for Labor to accept in full. So we have the political fight over tax cuts. The first instalment of that is a $1,000 tax offset for 10 million workers. It's up to $1,000 and it would apply when they lodge their tax returns after July 1. So it's pretty immediate. The third element, a focus on congestion and infrastructure. There is some mystery funding here. They've put money aside for it, but we won't see the detail of all this spending until the election campaign. So that gives them some firepower to fight the election. The fourth element really is something that they would rather not talk about, and that's the economic headwinds, and that's the fact that the outlook for wages is not as rosy. The outlook for GDP growth is deteriorated somewhat. So there are these danger signs. So at the same time that they're making some forecasts about surpluses and big tax cuts, they've also got this challenge with the state of the global economy and the state of the Australian economy. So it's a difficult picture.
Mm. All right, I already have about 10 questions for you, but let's do it one at a time. Jess, let's talk about tax.
Yep.
Your take on there's three phases to this package that was announced last night, which builds on a sort of three-phase package from last year.
Yeah, it was a bit of a turnaround from last year's budget lockup when they had the $140 billion of the three-stage, multi-stage, ambitious tax cut plan that if you tried to extract from them how much it was actually going to cost, they were not particularly forthcoming, although they did confirm it. It was a change this year. Now sort of Josh Frydenberg shouting from the rooftops, we've got $158 billion of tax cuts for you. Of course, only a little bit of it is actually accounted for by that $1,000 tax offset in the next sort of four years. But we've got, again, this sort of multi-stage. After 4 years, that tax offset expires. But to lock in those gains and match what Labor's doing, because their tax offset doesn't expire, it keeps going. We're now tinkering with the threshold for the 19-cent rate increases from $41,000 to $45,000. And we're also increasing...
So that's phase two?
This is phase two, increases the low-income tax offset. Now, that locks in the gains for lower middle-income earners. But when you change the threshold, you also start giving benefits to everyone all the way up the income chain. So it gets a little bit more expensive. And then it gets even more expensive when they go to slash the 32-cent 32.5-cent tax rate to 30 cents from 2024, if you can wait that long. That's going to cost about $95 billion over just 6 years. So that's actually escalating to an annual cost of about $16 billion a year. That is huge. And that is what the coalition is saying. Vote for us for this. It's unlikely that Labor will match that amount. They haven't signed on to phase two or three of the initial plan. It looks like they will match that initial sort of low middle income $1,000. They might get $1,200 from Labor. But whether they will actually go for that really ambitious tax flattening and lowering that Frydenberg is after, and whether anyone believes that will actually ever happen.
Well, that is obviously another question, a political question that we can get to later, because it would involve them winning the next two elections after this election for any of this to be finally locked in. But what I would like to know is, in 10 years' time, if both last year's package and this year's package were to materialise, what would our income tax system look like? It would be much simpler, wouldn't it?
It would be simpler. There would be only four tax brackets, not five. And for every dollar that you earned between $45,000 up to $200,000, you'd pay a flat tax rate of 30 cents in the dollar, which is actually the same as the corporate tax rate. So that is what we're trying to do. We're trying to lower income taxes so that there isn't this arbitrage opportunity for everybody set up as a small business and only pay 30 cents in the dollar. You know, longer term, it is an ambitious thing to lower the tax scales, although it does make it less progressive if everyone's sort of paying the same percentage on their extra dollars that they earn. It does make for a flatter, slightly less progressive, which, you know, is taking more from the rich than the poor. So it is an ambitious thing that they're going after, and it would simplify the system overall.
Right. So before we go back into the politics of that, Shane, can we talk about infrastructure spending? Because that was the other big ticket from last night's budget.
Yes, we've got the $100 billion over 10 years, which so much of that is pushed out beyond, it's about 23, 24. For instance, there was money announced for the ACT, tiny amount, but it doesn't start till 21, 22. So,
Why do they do that?
Because they can't afford it straight up, and they want to make promises that sound huge. And like the tax cut is the perfect example. It's a huge number, which is incomprehensible to a normal human being, and even to the human beings in this room. These are really big numbers over long periods.
We are sort of normal.
I'm not convinced by that, Crowe.
No, come on, you guys live inside the Canberra bubble.
We do.
Jess and I escape the Canberra bubble.
Yes, the Sydney bubble's so much better.
Yeah, very normal.
So you've got the big projects, but we're getting into the urban congestion war that's going to take place over the next 5 weeks, where ScoMo is going to be announcing roundabouts and car parks. Like, one of the most amazing things. It's small. It's $500 million on a car park fund. Now, it's a straight rip from the ALP. You've had Anthony Albanese out there announcing car parks in key marginal seats, which just happen to be the most congested parts of Australia, are key marginal seats.
So are they car parks around public transport?
Around
so that
train
people
stations.
Can do the drive train thing to work.
That's exactly right. And for instance, Scott Morrison only 3 weeks ago announced six of them that happened to be in three Liberal held marginal seats in Melbourne in the southeastern suburbs. Now they've gone full car park, and they've got $500 million, which will get rolled out, and you can see you won't be able to. The streets of Melbourne, Sydney, and Brisbane are going to be congested by Scott Morrison turning up with eight Comcars to announce, we're going to build a roundabout here, we're going to put a car park here, we're going to add a lane here. It's going to be a really interesting part of the coming election campaign, because both the Labor Party and the Liberal Party have picked up in their polling the congestion issue. This whole package of increasing the urban congestion fund, spending money on car parks, has effectively come out of those reference groups that both parties have picked up on.
Okay. So what they're doing here is tapping into people's feeling of being overcrowded. And yet in the budget documents last night, it showed that despite rhetoric of cutting the migration intake, numbers of migrants are actually going up.
It is really interesting, because when it was announced that by the government that they, to deal with population pressures, they'd cut the the net migration number from 190 to 160,000. That Scott Morrison said this won't have a budget impact, and we can see why now, because temporary migration, particularly from foreign students, is actually going to increase. So the total nominal amount of migrants coming into the country is going to increase over the next 12 months, which is starkly at odds with what was announced just a couple of weeks ago. But again, it's tapping that issue about congestion. It's tapping that issue, which, well, we saw in the 2013 election campaign, the complaints that migrants are filling up the roads out to the seat of Lindsay in Western Sydney.
So why are those people not counted as far as the as economic impact? Because they're not here to contribute to
the
economy?
No, they're offsetting the temporary ones are offsetting the economic impact of cutting the permanent ones.
Right.
At the end of the day, you've still got people in the country.
And they're still using the roads and the trains. And
they're still buying furniture. They're still buying a Netflix subscription. They're still doing that. They're still adding into the economy. So you can, it's a complete pea and thimble trick around the economic impact of migration.
Hi, I'm Michael Batchelard. I'm the Investigations and Foreign Editor at The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald have by far the country's biggest investigations teams, breaking stories about corruption, crime, and social and political issues. We also have foreign correspondents in Asia, China, Europe, and the US. Both are expensive, but crucial to providing news for and by Australians that help our readers interpret the world. And if people value that, we need people to subscribe so we can keep doing it. Subscribers allow us to dig deeper into the important stories that matter to our readers.
So let's talk about the state of the economy. There's plenty of revenue coming in, but there is still these sort of ominous signs on the horizon, aren't they, Jess?
Yeah, it's sort of weather metaphors galore. There's headwinds,
storm,
it's brewing, it's here, it's not here.
We had some dark and stormy clouds on the front page of the Sydney Morning Herald this morning.
It's on the horizon. We've sort of had this interesting story about the real activity is pretty strong in the jobs market. Everyone's got a job, but they're not getting pay rises. With the revenue story, you know, we've got prices are pretty strong, actually, and that's what's been delivering those windfall surpluses. Could have been surpluses, we've spent some. The revenue windfalls have come from higher commodity prices than we expected. So in the short term, the budget's sort of looking pretty good, but on the long term, people think that the assumptions that are built into this budget are still fairly optimistic for what we can expect to see from economic growth and from wages. So there's sort of maybe there's a temporary sort of 15 minutes of sunshine. Have we used that metaphor yet?
We haven't gone back to 1987 yet, but we will.
Have you had an economic sun shower?
It's raining, but it's sunny. It's very confusing. And I think there is a question of whether all these sort of projections are built on sand, and they could be blown away by sort of, you know, anything that happens.
A sandstorm, perhaps.
A sandstorm.
Which gets back to this debate that we've been having for several years now about whether the government has anything in the budget tank if there is a downturn. I mean, if there are storm clouds on the horizon, that is actually an argument for having a surplus this year and not having a deficit of $4 billion this year. You know, if there's any possible way to actually get the budget into better shape for a potential downturn. And yet they haven't done that because they've made the calculation that it's better to offer tax cuts, it's better to spend on infrastructure, and the political dividend from producing a surplus this year instead of a deficit of $4 billion is simply not great enough to justify a bit of belt tightening.
I've been wondering whether this is actually a stimulus budget without the word stimulus.
Well, this is what Ross Gittins wrote this morning.
And Ross is onto something
in that
space.
They're being completely political about giving these this first tranche of the sort of $19.5 billion over the next 4 years, with some of which will come in as soon as people put their tax returns in, is actually stimulus. And even though they're doing it for political reasons, it might be the right thing to do.
Well, you can look at, say, like the GST revenues, which they've downgraded GST, which is the best indicator of what households are doing. And so that's saying, well, if the household sector is not doing as well, then that means the overall economy is not doing well. There was a movement of grants to local councils. They've moved $1.3 billion worth of grants from the coming year into the current year, as in, here's a roundabout construction sale, build it now. They're throwing $1.3 billion out in the next 10 weeks. So that's telling you something else, that maybe Treasury's thought, maybe a little bit of assistance.
But that also deepens the deficit this year and makes next year's surplus look a little healthier.
$1.3 billion healthier, exactly. But the argument that if you're trying to get all this money out from July 1, let's get money into construction, that has the whiff of a bit of stimulation.
Yeah, we're all Keynesians now, it seems like. And someone pointed out...
Which is great if you've got money, though, right? I mean, the only reason Kevin Rudd was able to throw bucket loads of money at the economy was because it was there, because they'd been running surpluses for so long and paying down debt.
And that's right.
Frydenberg was pointing out these are the biggest sort of income tax cuts since the Howard and Costello governments, but they were doing it from a sort of zero net debt situation. We've still got $374 billion of debt that, instead of just getting into surplus, we could maybe have built bigger surpluses over the coming years. Well, and we would have been paying down some of that faster.
Did you actually notice that gross debt's gone up? They've actually have pushed it up.
Yeah.
And net
debt, and net debt improves because the value of the assets improves.
Yeah,
not because the gross debt is suddenly dematerialising.
No, it's not.
So how is someone like Josh Frydenberg supposed to explain, when he stands up and says, who do you trust to manage the economy? It's a very complicated question to answer, because I think most Australians would think of the economy as, they would take in interest rates as part of that. They would take in certainly wages, which no one seems to have been able to address, and I'd like to get into that a little bit. But do you think that Australians look at things like whether there's money put away for a future downturn, or do you think they're more concerned about here and now?
No, I don't think they are factoring in that money put away for the downturn. But I do think that this is still the coalition's strong suit, and they've doubled down on last year's $144 billion with $158 billion, because tax cuts are the thing that they can sell with some discipline, rather than having another fight over climate change within their own ranks. And it is something where they can point to the fact that you may quibble over the $4 billion deficit this year and the $7 billion surplus next year, but the trajectory is toward a surplus. And that is a huge change over 12 years of really staggeringly large deficits. And that's a very good outcome. You can argue about whether it could be a better outcome and they could have done more faster, but they are on that trajectory, and it is something that that plays to their strengths. And it's a good reason why this is the platform for them to go to an election as soon as possible, in my view, because this is what they should want the election campaign to be about. The subject matter in the campaign will change, but I think they've got good grounds to tell voters that this is a... this is a better economic story that they've got.
Let's talk about wages. Shane, what were the forecasts for national wage growth?
We've come down to 2.75%. That's another 0.5%, well, effectively 0.25% down from where they were at MyEFO. And then the following year, there's a spike in wages growth to 3.25%. Even though unemployment is steady, and jobs growth is falling.
So that's pretty optimistic, isn't it?
Yeah, and there's a fair few economists already saying, well, you actually can't get there, unless they're forecasting or predicting that the Reserve Bank is going to start cutting interest rates. And I noticed last night the markets have dramatically changed again. They've put a 1 in 3 chance of a rate cut about 5 days out from polling day, polling day's on the 11th. Those sort of factors are in there. So the wages story continues. This is the sixth year in a row where Treasury's had to downgrade.
Has anyone, any economists or commentators or politicians or Treasury people, given an explanation for why we seem to be in this kind of quagmire?
Well, you've seen there's a large amount of discussion globally. The Laurie Sumner's argument of secular stagnation, as we've come out of the GFC, the diminishment of power of unions, whether collective bargaining, and we saw there was actually some figures just last week showing new enterprise bargaining results actually fell from 3.2 to 2.8% growth. And the Reserve Bank's also on the theory that people are afraid to ask for bigger pay rises now because they think businesses won't give them to them, and businesses are afraid they can't increase wages because of the competitive environment that they're in. There are more reasons than pages to a budget at the moment as to what's going on. And yet Treasury maintains the line, well, the jobs market will tighten, that will push up wages. That's the traditional view, isn't it, Jess?
Well, it's what's happened in the United States.
Except they've had a bit of inflation as well. Yeah. So if you pull out real wages growth, it's not there. Right. It is flat, and they've got an unemployment rate under 4%. And you've also had lots of state governments in the US lifting the minimum wage. If the minimum wage in this country hadn't been lifted the last couple of years, wages growth would be substantially right. lower.
So the one thing that is really clear is that Bill Shorten has worked out that this is a really emotional issue for people and is going to make it central to the election campaign. What is his message about what he is actually going to do about wage growth?
Amend the workplace relations law, and this is his big, big promise. He cannot actually force a change in wages for the bulk of the workforce, but first of all, he's going to change the law to lift penalty rates. He's going to undo the cuts to penalty rates. Second, he's going to change the workplace law to change the way the minimum wage is set. That can flow through to a lot of workers. Thirdly, he's talking about the fact that enterprise bargaining is not getting results, back to Shane's point. Now, he's raising expectations about what he can do. Whether he can do all of that is something that, is one of the big questions of the election campaign. Can he deliver on all this? But he's certainly setting out these ambitions, and whether that flows through enough to break this quagmire of wages is one of the big, big questions. But he's certainly got that ambition.
The central theme of his speech tomorrow night, because he gets to reply to the budget and isn't shackled by having to have detail like the treasurer. I mean, what do you think he will be? Will he be hammering this wages theme?
Yes. I think this is the big contrast, because he says we have the answer to lift wages. Josh Frydenberg and Scott Morrison say we have the big tax cuts that you all need, and Labor can't be trusted on tax. And that's the contrast. The question for voters is whether they would put more trust in Labor to deliver higher wages, or more trust in the coalition to cut their taxes. And it really does start to become as stark as that during the election campaign, I think.
Yeah. So has there ever been a federal budget so close to the beginning of an election campaign?
No. Shane Wright has done the numbers on this, and he's looked at the
history. It's pretty tragic
that
I've done the numbers on this. Yes. No. Budget dates have moved around over the years. August was always a traditional period. There have been ones later, ones earlier, but never 5 weeks out. We're in the new world. Last election, 2016, as we all remember, like the War and Peace election campaign, that was 8 weeks, and that nobbled just about everybody. But the budget was central. It was the jobs and growth, company tax cuts.
Malcolm Turnbull was Napoleon Bonaparte retreating from Moscow with people.
And he lost almost as many of the Grand Army.
All but one.
And the parallel here, I often think of as the 2007 campaign, where John Howard and Peter Costello announced their economic plan just before the formal campaign began. And then Labor's first decision in the campaign was how much of the Costello-Howard tax cuts to accept. And Labor ended up accepting most of them and then tweaking them. We kind of see the same dynamic here. The decision for Labor is how much of the $158 billion to accept and what to modify. I don't actually think it's a difficult challenge for Bill Shorten and Chris Bowen. I don't think that it's a fight that they mind having. In fact, it's the fight that they want, because it's the fairness fight that Bill Shorten has been prosecuting for so long. And it means that they can accept the $1,000 tax offset for so many workers now, and reject or modify those second and third stages on the grounds that, according to the Labor claim, out of $302 billion in tax cuts that have been announced last year and this year over a decade, about $150 billion of that goes to workers on the higher incomes. So Labor sees this as a fairness fight, and that's something that they're very glad to do. One thing that I find really fascinating about the budget is that this budget can't be called a game changer because it doesn't change the game at all. It's the same game from last year. We're now seeing exactly the same debate, just with different numbers. How much of the tax cut do you accept? Which part do you think is too regressive? How do you modify the package? Each side plays to their base, and that's the way they fight the campaign.
It's a different Prime Minister and a different Treasurer. And who and the Prime Minister, you know, has to make the cut. Well, if everything's the same, why am I here and Malcolm Turnbull's not the Prime Minister?
And we see conservative commentators hailing this budget as one that's true Liberal values. Well, $144 billion last year, $158 billion this year. What's the difference? $12 billion?
That's Liberal value is $14 billion.
Yeah. It's pretty much the same game plan, even though we've seen this convulsion over the leadership within the government.
Have they left themselves any cash up their sleeves for some kind of thing to dazzle voters during the campaign? Or do we pretty much now know what's on offer?
I think there was a couple of billion socked away in there, maybe about 2 billion or so. But what's been interesting today is Frydenberg has come out and actually added in another thing that wasn't in the budget, which is that the pension payment, the energy supplement for pensioners, is now going to go to NewStart recipients as well, because he's come under a lot of pressure for, hey, you're giving away $302 billion. What about NewStart? Which, you know, Jennifer Westacott at the Business Council and Cassandra Goldie at ACOS, you know, there's sort of hands across the divide for the community sector and the business sector to say that Newstart was something that was neglected and there should have been some money found. And so there has been some money found this morning, I believe.
So he delivered the budget at 7:30 last night, and at 7:30 this morning
is saying
has extended it. How does something like that happen?
Well, it was really intriguing in that how he explained, he justified the reason not to give Newstart recipients this money, and then said, but we're still doing it anyway. No voter left behind now, and let's throw some more cash around.
Yeah,
I mean, it's sort of all getting into the hypothetical. We're just sort of throwing large numbers around.
This is only another 50 mil.
You know, whatever. I think we should go back to you Unless only it's got allowed a billion. To talk about the forward estimates. Forget all this 10-year business on the never-never. You know, if you can't deliver it in the next 4 years, politics is such a short-term game that it's probably not going to happen, or it's not feasible. For the forecasts that we're coming up with are so subject to variation, and we know that. We just shouldn't be talking about what's happening.
How about just the next year?
Just next year.
Just next year.
We did our tax tables just, what are you going to get this year? Because the rest of it is so hard for people to comprehend. Yeah. You know, in 2025, I'm going to get this. I think it's almost meaningless to talk about that.
I do. I think it's interesting because last year was the first time in a budget where it was a 10-year plan for tax cuts, and they didn't even, as you said, in last year's budget papers provide what the cost was going to be. This year they learnt that lesson. David, you've done many budgets. We've all done many budgets. Do you think it should be focused on the 4 years of the Ford estimates, or do you think it's legitimate for a government to go, you wanted long-term thinking from us, here's some long-term thinking?
I think there is a good argument for having some kind of longer term outlook. And I think that's been a good thing with some of the policy debates. But I do think that we've reached the stage now where the numbers are highly theoretical and highly unreliable. We've seen the wages forecasts being consistently wrong in the budgets in recent years. We saw a long period where the tax revenue forecasts were consistently wrong. This budget still commits the same mistake that so many have done over the last 12 years, which is that it spends money over the next 10 years, assuming a rosy forecast over the next 10 years. And that is a fundamental weakness in the way these budgets are being prepared, because the money assumes to keep coming in, and they make policy decisions now to spend it all. And so I think a four-year outlook is much wiser.
Okay, I'm going to look at you all and say final verdict. It's a tough one because it's always a complicated question, but good budget?
A bit boring.
Oh, it's a pass.
I think it's a pass too. I think it's the best they can do in the political predicament they find themselves in, playing to their strengths.
And it's given them a leaping off point to stay on track for the campaign and stop talking about peripheral issues.
Highly political document, highly theoretical, long-term forecasts, and it's made to last for 6 weeks. Mm.
But the leaping off could be into electoral oblivion as well in 6 weeks' time.
Yes, could be. First and last ever budget delivered by Treasurer Josh Frydenberg. On that cheery note, poor Mr. Frydenberg. Thanks so much for joining me, guys.
Thanks.
No Cheers.
Thanks to our guests this week, David Crowe, Jessica Irvine and Shane Wright. You'll be hearing from these three a lot during the election campaign. As well as the weekly episodes of Please Explain, we'll be doing bonus 10-minute extras throughout the week when there are developments that you might like to know about. Make sure you're subscribed so you get an alert when they drop. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Support the work we do. You can find the link to sign up in our show notes or just search Subscribe Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. If you want to get in touch, you can. Our email is in the show notes as well. This episode was produced and edited by Nicole Preesel. Technical assistance from David McMillan. And Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Tori. Thanks for listening.